This episode contains discussion of sexual assault and suicide. I think a lot of us have been at work, at a job, and thought, this isn't natural. Spending 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day just here, in this place, doing this task over and over for decades? This is weird, is what it is. This is not what my body or mind are meant to do. This isn't my natural state. And maybe that wears on you. Maybe that wears you down. I don't know. Maybe you're listening to this podcast while you work, and I hope that helps. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here, even if you have to also be there. Now take the strangeness and fatigue of a demanding job and stretch it out past 8 to 10 hours all the way to 24 hours. A job where you have to live there. So even if you're not on the clock, you're still there. Even when you're not on the job, you're at the job. That's the kind of environment that Kate Beaton writes about and draws about in the graphic memoir Ducks, 2 Years in the Oil Sands. It's a remarkable book and has been on several 2022 Best Books of the Year lists. Kate Beaton is also the author and artist of Hark a Vagrant, a very popular historical comic series that is much more lighthearted. Ducks, and we'll explain the title later in the interview, is about the period after college where Kate worked in what's called the oil sands in Canada. It's a remote area with large deposits of heavy crude oil in the ground. Hundreds of workers live on site in camps or in a nearby town. They're almost all men, and if they have families, the families usually live far away. And as Kate Beaton depicts it, life there is not easy. Drug use, depression, isolation, marriages collapsing. And there are plenty of problems unique to the few women who work in the camps at those oil sands as well. Ducks is about what happens, including to mental health, if you provide some pretty good financial compensation, but strip away a lot of humanity and society from people. Kate Beaton, welcome to Depression Mode.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Where are you joining us from right now?
I'm joining you from my home in Nova Scotia, and yeah, it's a beautiful day.
Is this the same town where you grew up?
It is. Yes, it is.
Okay, great. Well, I read Ducks, and it's an extraordinary book, and I highly recommend it to people. Let's begin. Who were you when you went to work in the oil sands?
I was a very young person. I was 21, I think, 22. I was recently graduated from university with a Bachelor of the Arts. And you know how people are just handing over jobs to to BAs.
Yeah. Go work at the big anthropology factory at the edge
yes,
of town.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I had a student loan to pay off. And I didn't want to just accrue more loans by going into further education at that moment, because you would really have to know exactly what you were doing, go into law or go into, you know, getting your PhD or something. And I was from a very economically depressed area. So the idea of digging a further debt was a sort of a terrifying prospect as well. I really wanted to get rid of the debt that I had.
Yeah, and you write about in the book how in order to make one's money, one has to leave. There's sort of a sadness baked into the economic reality of where you leave, yeah. Of where you lived.
Yeah. Where are you from?
I'm from Seattle originally. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota now.
Okay. I was wondering if it was a place with a sort of a similar vibe.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I mean, here we have North Dakota, where several years ago, a lot of people kind of went gold rushing up there, and they had rapid economic development that was somewhat unsustainable, I think.
Yes, yeah, they had the man camps there as well. But here, this has been a generations long reality of economic migration that is baked into your sense of self and the culture. And away is where the prosperity is. But home is where the soul is. So you're really riven from the start with messages of having to leave, but losing yourself and having to make that choice.
Yeah. It's almost like going off to war in a sense.
Yeah. But people have been doing it for so long. You know, we have letters from relatives going back to, you know, we have a letter from 1904 from somebody who went mining in Montana. And he's like, maybe I'll make it back to Mabu before I die. And he doesn't. And wow. This sense of loss and leaving and going for work because you have to is quite an ingrained reality.
And where is Fort McMurray where you went?
Fort McMurray is in the north of Alberta, which is a central Canadian province, just east of the Rocky Mountains. I know to the U.S., like all of Canada is north.
Yes.
But it's quite north. It's quite north, even for us.
If you could find Edmonton on a map and keep going for quite a while, that's where you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about what happens in these camps and in these towns. But I, being the show we are, I think about how it would be such a difficult place to go to, especially, you know, as a young person, and how challenging it would be from a mental health standpoint. What was your mental state when you began this work?
It was unprepared.
Yeah.
Definitely. I come from that in the clouds sort of liminal place where you are in university, where you are not yet a part of regular adult society. You are just, you're in this sort of fringe area where it's an idealized version of adulthood without any of the responsibilities, and you socialize only with your peers, and everybody is sort of, you know, it's a very sort of careless time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're debating big ideas and everything, and you don't.
Right.
Yeah, you're like, oh, well, my ideal society, and, you know. And then you get thrown into the fire, and you're like, oh, fuck.
This isn't my ideal society at all.
That's not my ideal society. So, you know, and I went to school with people who were from all different sort of class backgrounds, too. And then I went back to my class, which is this working class, lower class. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is who I am. This is me.
Oh.
You know, because other people that I went to school with, you know, they were like, they were going to law school. And they were doing things like unpaid internships. And it was kind of like, no, this is who you are. You go to work. And you go in the, like, camp, the oil camp.
Yeah.
Don't think that high of yourself. Just because you have your fancy degree, don't think that high of yourself.
Yeah, you're not better than me, kind of thing.
Yeah, you're not better than me. And then, too, like you had the guys in there who took trades, and they were from my socioeconomic class, and they were like, don't think you're better than me, like school pants. Like, I make more money than you. I make 10 times the money than you. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you do. Because I made way less money.
I really hope they called you school pants. I don't think they did.
I was trying to think of like what they called me. It wasn't school pants. It was like university or something. Like, you think you're so fancy. You think you're so fucking fancy with your university degree.
Yep.
And I was like, I really don't. really don't. my BA... it's like the lowest degree imaginable.
Right.
No one's impressed by a BA ever. But I was not prepared for the slap in the face reality that was that, and like any entry into the working world is a kind of like a rush of cold air, I think, but in a boom town especially, and then to work in the camps. Because a boom town is a particular mindset. It is the young men coming from money, spending unwisely, spending like crazy, highs and lows, like immense highs and lows of society. You have like people making hand over fist, but you also have people, broken people, strewn about. And it was all laid in front of you. So like gigantic trucks rolling around town that cost like $100,000. and jacked up and everything, and people just like flashing their immediate wealth around in this cold place, you know, alleviating their boredom by spending. And then on the flip side, people who came and didn't do well immediately, or who succumbed to addiction and things like that. So there was a lot of people who had nowhere to live and they were on the streets, or who were engaged in things like sex work. And it was the first time I had ever been around things like that in my like sort of coddled life.
So the first year you were there, then you didn't live in the camps, you lived in the town, correct?
For the first few months, I lived in the town. For the first few months.
Okay, yeah, because people move around from job to job. What was your job when you got there?
First, I worked in a restaurant while I tried to get a job in the oil field, because the oil place is where you get the money. And then I got a job in the oil. It's Syncrude, and I worked in a tool crib, which is like a... My uncle told me to get a job in a tool crib because he had worked in Sudbury when that place was booming in the 60s, and he knew all about, because everybody knows all about all these jobs. So he was like, you get a job in the tool crib, girl. Like, you'll be all right there, because you don't need a trade and you can work on site. So I was like, okay, I didn't know what the fuck that was, but I was like, all right, I'll do that. It's like handing out tools and doing inventory and managing people's, like the tradesmen's tools of the trade, so that the jobs and the can keep running. Because if they don't have the things that they need, then the work stops. And you're the face of the equipment shed.
You're one of few women working in the enterprise overall. Which...
Yes, and that becomes very apparent, and that becomes my like main feature of existence on site,
yeah.
Which is what marks my story over a lot of other people's, because everybody's version of the oil sands is different. But because I was a young woman there by myself, that is what makes me stick out, is that I'm a woman in a place that's so predominantly male on site.
Yeah. And in the tool crib, especially, it's impossible to avoid people. Like, your job is that men can come up and talk to you.
Yes, they come up and they're looking for things, and then they have, you know, they talk to you, they have to talk to you, you have to talk to them. So you're the interface. And so you're dealing with people all day. And I had never experienced real sexual harassment until that point. I mean, every woman does, but not at the volume that kind of volume, and not where you're dealing with people's unloading of their issues in that way. Because again, you're in this boom town. And when I said like people, you know, like volumes of men coming and having any kind of issue that comes with that, like making lots of money or developing mental health issues or having loneliness or frustration or everything. And those things will pile on top of you because you are an avatar of like a woman.
Right. Yeah, you symbolize femininity and womanhood.
Yeah, you're just there. And it's not personal at all. They're bored, they're lonely, and you're standing right there, and you have to talk to them. So it can be anything from people who are so alone that they genuinely feel like they have a connection to you when they wouldn't even talk to you in like the real life, to people who are aggressive. And all of that falls on you. And if you've never dealt with it, you know, I had, you know, rude comments and things in my life, but not everything all at once that way. It made you feel extremely dehumanized. And immediately it was difficult.
And there wasn't much of a system in place to protect you.
Oh, fuck, there was nothing.
There was nothing at all.
Jesus. No, there's like the oil companies are like, we have a zero tolerance policy. It's complete bullshit. I think there was like, I think on like day one, there's like a video they show you where it's like, don't explode yourself. Don't harass other people. Don't like whatever. Anyway, go to work now. And that's it. And then like, if you go to like any of the oil companies' websites, Syncrude or whatever, it's like full of like smiling women and smiling black people and stuff. And they're like, we love to work for Syncrude and we love Shell or whatever. And you know, they fill it with like people of color and women. And it's all just like complete optics and bullshit. And
much like a college brochure.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Where they like pull somebody and they're like, wow, you love working here. And they're like, what the hell am I doing in this picture? Because if you had to, like, if you had zero tolerance, you'd be firing everyone on site. And you learn very quickly what happens when like a woman actually complains, which is she's a pariah and the men hate her. She's a bitch and she's an ice queen and she made this guy's life hell and she got this guy fired for no reason. All this stuff, like anything at all. And nobody gossips more than those guys on site. They're so bored. And so anything that they say about you is true immediately. And the most that you want is just to work and do your, and just be left alone. So you just don't, and they already have in their mind this boogeyman of a boogeywoman, I guess, who does do all this stuff, who does is just like has a hair trigger and is getting men fired left and right for nothing, for like accidentally looking at her the wrong way and just storming into like the office and being like, this man is harassing me and getting him fired. And fucking no one's doing that.
Right.
There's nobody doing that. All the women are just like, just let me do my job. Just leave me alone. And they put up with so much shit. And still like the men are like, women are getting men fired all the time. And like, you can't say nothing. And you're just like, my sense of self is just gone and disappeared. And like, I put up with so much shit every day from the things that people say to me, which was anything from like, oh, like I can't even pay attention to what you're saying because I'm lost in these big brown eyes to like the grossest, what's your name? Katie. I have an 8-month-old daughter named Katie. She's beautiful. And you're like, are you hitting on me with your baby daughter's name? What the fuck?
Interesting technique.
What a technique. Oh, let me fly into your arms. Jesus Christ.
I'll be your new baby. What?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He's like leaning in like too close while he says it. Oh, you're just like, no. Why is this happening?
Coming up, more of Kate's story and the stories of people she lived with and worked with and struggled with. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
Parenting. It's hard, but don't worry, you're not alone. Belly up to the low bar with One Bad Mother and let us remind you that fine is good enough.
they want to climb on different things. And how am I supposed to keep them both from dying?
There is a right way to do this. And if I can figure out that right way, I'm going to be a good parent. So that is not a thing.
So join us each week and let us tell you that you are doing a good job. You can listen to One Bad Mother on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with Kate Beaton, author and illustrator of Ducks, 2 Years in the Oil Sands. Something I really love about the book is that it's long enough that you spend time with a lot of the people in these camps, and the stories unfold, and some very tough things happen to some of these coworkers of yours.
Yeah.
Did you have an awareness of everything that was going on, the substance use, the depression, the self-harm?
No, it took a while because in the beginning, when so much is happening, like to me, like I said, it was like a when all this like harassment and stuff is happening, you're really just going into work every day like a deer in the headlights. You're like, oh, I don't even know what the hell is happening, and you're looking around at your coworkers and you're not really seeing them for everything that's happening to them, because it's so much to acclimate to. But over time, like as the book progresses, and I get to know the people around me, like the bigger picture sort of comes into focus. In the tool crib, it just happens to be where that's, like I said, that's where you people went if they didn't have a trade. So there was a lot of older men there too, who had lost their jobs in things like the fisheries back home or the coal mines because they didn't have trades. They started working in the coal mines or whatever when they were like in grade 8, and that's when they left school. So it's not like they came to the oil sands with like as carpenters or something. They didn't have that. They had like a grade 9 education. So that's who I was working with. So that's who you sort of get to know. And like they left their families back home, and some of them were going through divorces because those job sites were very hard on families. You work for 14 days on and then 7 days off, or 21 days on and then 8 days off. And 2 of the days off would be spent flying back, traveling to your family.
Right.
And then when you get home, in a way I was very lucky because I was there young and unattached. But when you get home, there's a cycle that goes on all the time. You're at work and you're like, I can't wait to get home to my family. I can't wait to get home. And then you get home and the first day that you're there, you're like, oh, hooray, hooray, like I'm here. But then the wife is like, hooray, he's here. It's my time to relax. But he's like, I'm here. It's my time to relax. And right. They're both like, they've both been waiting for someone to like take some of the load off.
Everybody's exhausted.
But there's also like the familial bliss for like a few days. But then as like the days creep closer to when he has to go back to work, when he has to fly away, they've been saving all the things that they actually have to like be serious about, be argue about for like the last day or two. Then they do that. And then it kind of like leaves on a bad foot. Like, oh, we have to argue about money now, about this thing. And then he's like, oh, fuck, like goodbye. He leaves. And it's kind of like perfunctory, like bye, see you in a few weeks. Like now that we've argued about these like shitty, like relationship, it's hard. It's hard. And you could see it. You can absolutely see how that would be. There's nothing like natural about it. And then he's gone for like 2 or 3 weeks and he's not back again until then. And it happens all over again.
The cycle returns. Yeah.
Yeah. The cycle returns. And the kids, it's so hard on the kids. If you talk to any of the teachers, they're like, oh, we know the oil sands kids. We know who they are.
We can when spot their patterns. Yeah.
Yeah. When daddy's back, like they can't sit down. He's back. They're jumping up and down. They can't concentrate. And when he goes, they're just like slumped in their desk and they're sullen and they act out. You know, they retaliate in class. But that is difficult on a child. Like that kind of mental health cycle on them for someone so young, it's very predictable. And I don't envy those guys. I don't envy those families how difficult that is. It's a damaging process. And so I'd watch these sort of things play out, but only on my end in the oil sands. And I learned more about it later, what was going on. but I would ask some questions too. And so, you know, they'd call it like the divorce capital of Canada up there. And I remember coming into one of the guys, he got a divorce, and I, you know, there's no help either when you're going through that. I remember I was like sorting nails, which is the stupid, or screws, like for drills, because somebody dumped a box and I was sorting them. Stupid job.
Glamour.
I know. And somebody's like, have you seen this guy? And someone was like, no, he's been fucking useless since his wife left him. And I was like, Jesus Christ. The compassion here is just amazing.
Yeah.
So I went to visit him in his room, and he was only 42, and he had kids, like young kids, but that seemed really old to me because I was 22. I was like, this guy's old. Yeah. He was having a beer, and he was like, you're a nice girl, Katie, the way they are back home. Don't let the world change you. And I was like, Jesus, I'm only, you know, nothing's happened to me yet. That's all.
Just ahead, to tell her whole story about life in the oil sands, Kate needed to include some events that were traumatic. She talks about that after the break.
This week on Bullseye, Tom Hanks, as you've never heard him before, mad.
You moron. Thank you for the use of the turn signal. Way to use your blinker, idiot.
That's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Back with Kate Beaton, author and illustrator of Ducks, 2 Years in the Oil Sands. In the book, you describe some pretty traumatic events that happened to you, and some of them are quite devastating. Yeah. Do you want to talk about what those events were?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I got to say, this was before those things. I mean, things had happened to me. I was being harassed on site daily, but you know what I mean. I hadn't gotten married. I haven't had kids. I hadn't had all this stuff that like the real life shit that he was going through. I hadn't had those things. And whereas like he was dealing with the real meat of life, you know, I'm married now and I have kids and I have a marriage and like that shit is hard. But yes, of course, like I build through the book purposefully for the reader. Like I guide them through, I hope, what it's like to be a vulnerable person in that environment when you have that kind of harassment going on day to day. Big and small, that pick at you, that picks at your sense of self and your sense of safety until the inevitable happened, because I do put sexual assault in the book, which happens to me. In some ways, like I won't detail what it is because I feel like I will leave that to the reader to see.
Sure.
But it's not surprising that it happens because it's so common. It's just a common thing in life. But in a place like that, where the gender imbalance is what it is, there's a real silence around sexual violence in general. But in the oil sands in particular, you almost never hear about it. And yet, of course it happens. Of course it happens. It
must happen a lot, of course. Why, you know, you didn't, I mean, you didn't have to write the book at all. You felt a need to write the book, and you didn't have to include those traumatic events in the book. Why did you include them?
Well, I thought about it, and I could have protected myself by not including those things, but if I didn't put them in there, it would have been a lie. It would have been a sanitized version, and it would have been. It just would have been a lie. It wouldn't have been the whole truth. And there's a lot of things that would have been left out, that are left out of the book because you can only put so many things in. But if I left out those things, then the thing that I have carried with me the most from that place would be missing. And that is, it's too big. It's too important. I mean, there's nothing that has left an imprint on me like that. And And I mean, it's affected relationships. It's affected my sense of self, my sense of my body, my mind, everything. And to the people who did it to me, it was nothing. It was absolutely fucking nothing to them. And that, I think, was also an important thing to depict, how completely, you know, nothing the act was to the ones who did it, because it was a moment's thought. And it's been my whole life.
Did it seem like trauma at the time? Could you even wrap your head around what had happened?
No, because I had to go to work the next day, and I show that too. Like the next day, I remember coming in, and my boss was like, "You look like shit." And he laughed at me, and I was like, "I bet I do, I do," because yeah. You know, I feel like it's some media depictions. It's like this. They don't show how it's just part of your regular life. How like something happens, and then like the next day, you go to work. It's not like the presses stop. It's just your life keeps going the way that it, like you go to school the next day or whatever, or, you know, you go out and the show continues. And I also show that it takes a while to process. In the book, I don't talk to somebody about it until much later. And I don't really talk to somebody about it until way later in the book in a truthful way. I kid myself about it for a while. I don't reconcile. And that's natural, I think. There are things I don't remember. I walked around in a fugue state in the middle of the night at one point, and I still don't remember that. I put that in there. Somebody was like, "I saw you walking around outside at like 2 a.m. Do you remember that?" And I was like, "No. No, I don't remember that." Very strange things will happen after trauma, and you don't know what they're going to be. You don't know how you're going to process it, and you don't know how you're going to react to things. It takes me a long time throughout the book to sort of process. I show myself like a year later in a different city, and I'm on a date with someone, and he tries to kiss me, but I keep laughing, which is a strange response. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "What's so funny?" And he's kind of offended. But I'm like, "Nothing's funny." But I just had the very bizarre kind of reaction to somebody trying to kiss me, just to start laughing uncontrollably. I don't know. You can't put your finger on exactly what the effects are going to be.
Have you ever sought help for processing that?
Oh yeah, I've seen lots of therapists.
Yeah.
So many.
I'm glad. How has that worked out?
I got to say, it's a mixed bag. One thing is for sure. There are not that many therapists, especially in the beginning, who knew what to do with the fact that sexual assault happened in a camp, in a work camp. A lot of them would take that information and be like, "Let's talk about your relationship with food. Let's talk about your relationship with your mom." And you'd be like, "But I lived in a work camp with 1,200 men." And they'd be like, "Yeah, we talked about that last week." And you'd be like, "But..."
It's kind of a big one.
It felt like being gaslit, as if like that didn't matter or that was over.
Yeah.
And then you realize after a while that like, that they didn't know how to deal with it, that they were not equipped to handle it. And they just had no tools for that scenario. And then I was thinking about like the men who lived in the camps who were often in mental health crisis. And by that, I mean like, and I show some of them in the book, like my coworker who's Ryan in the book, who was battling addiction. And there were lots of them. And the oil companies are like, "Oh, we have like resources." And you're like, "Their resources are garbage."
What were the resources?
There was like a phone number you could call, and it was like someone who's like, "Hello, like, how are you feeling?" And they're like, "I think I'm going to like kill myself. And I think that like my life is in turmoil and like my marriage is ending. And like, I live in this work camp." And they're like, "Oh no." And like, like they just couldn't, They couldn't handle it because I talked to him. I talked to him before when I was making the book, and I was like, what happened? What happened when you called that number? And they were underpaid therapists who were completely unequipped for the type of crisis that people would be in, and they specific to these work environments that are built to create mental distress, especially among male workers, because of the pressure that they feel to make money and to perform masculinity and to hide the pain that they feel when they have pain, and the addiction issues that are ever present. And I was so unaware of a lot of the addiction because I was so naive about it. But a lot of my coworkers were addicted to cocaine, to Percocet, to different things. And I'd find out about it later, and I was like, oh my God, really? And people would be like, you dumb, like, child. Like, of course they were high all the time. They were high every day, and they were operating gigantic machines, and they were on cocaine. And it would start because you weren't allowed to smoke weed because you would fail the piss test. Mm. And you could piss out cocaine real fast.
Right.
And then people would get addicted, and then they would take Percocets to wake up. It was just a cycle of horrible pain, especially if things in their personal life were going off the rails, which they often were because of these emotional cycles. And then the companies, it was in the company's interest to just let them go and have these wreckages of human beings destroy themselves somewhere else, where they had created the conditions under which their lives fell apart. There were accidents on site that were swept under the rug, and there was just so much. Anyway, it was a place of mental anguish.
Yeah.
It was hard to watch.
Ducks is a beautiful book and a huge book. It must have been a huge, long undertaking. And I mean, I've written some books and I know how incredibly intensive the commitment is. And I've never illustrated a book that I've written. So it's doubly intensive, you know, so in order to do it, it must be such an important story to tell that you're willing to put yourself through all that. Why was this such an important story for you to tell?
I was never able to leave the place in a lot of ways. I left, but I could never really leave. It was a book that I was always going to do. I thought about that place a lot. And there are people who I worked with who did die. And
by suicide or overdose?
Overdose.
Overdose.
Yeah. And there are people who got out of it. And there are people who still work there. And of course, my sister got cancer too, but I had already started the book when that happened. I had, you know, the idea that I would do the book in 2014, but she was diagnosed in 2015. But it's always sat with me. And, you know, there's not many places in your life where you still live with that walk with you. And Fort Memory is that place for me. And because of the things that I saw and everything, but also because this is the history of my place, my home, and what we have done, you know, going back generations, and what that means, what it means to have to leave to work, what you have to do, which I grew up with. But then when I walked into it, I'm witnessing what that meant. You know, because I have the uncles who have, you know, the hard hats that have dents in it from rock falls that they've been in and things like that. And this is all to be like, this is my birthright. This, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah. There's so many people in the book who you are talking to in Fort McMurray who are from your town or from Nova Scotia, even though it feels like an extension of your hometown, even though it's hundreds and hundreds of miles away.
Yeah, for a while it felt like people were getting raptured out there. Yeah. just this conveyor belt of bodies to the oil sands, because everything back home was shutting down. And then when you realize what that means for people, for their souls, just to put food on the table, it's a difficult thing to swallow.
Hmm. Has it been a catharsis for you to get this book out in the world?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I also have to say, like, some people go out there and they're fine. It's not you. We're speaking generalities because we're on a podcast that's only a few minutes long. But of course, some people go out there and they hold on to themselves and they're fine. But when you see the people who are not fine, it hurts. No, it feels good to have it out. Yes.
What's been the response from people? People who you knew in the camps, or people who are currently in the camps? You must hear from people who are out there right now.
Generally very good. No one has written to say that they hate it. So,
that's good.
But if they hate it, they probably are not writing to me. So,
yeah. And we should say the name of the book is Ducks. It's not a book about ducks. It's a book about people, but I think it might be helpful for people to hear why that's the name of the book.
Yeah. In 2008, when I was working there, hundreds of ducks, migrating ducks, flew into the tailings pond, which is the affluent pond at Syncrude Oil. And they thought it was a safe place to land, but because it was the affluent pond, they got stuck there and they died. And it was, I would say, one of the first times that the eyes of the world turned to the oil sands with concern and demanded to know what was happening. And the oil companies had to come out and apologize and regretfully talk about what they would do to make sure this never happened again, and the measures they would put in, and how sorry they were about the ducks. At the same time, you know, when I was witnessing so much human misery, which everyone turned a blind eye to, including the poisoning of indigenous communities downstream from the oil companies, Fort Chip and Fort Mackay, which was in the news at the same time, but did not get the same recognition. It was so hypocritical. The people felt very invisible. And the ducks were a tragedy, and it was terrible. And it was the response was appropriate. And yet, you know, if you were dying of cancer, if you had lost people you loved to cancer, and the oil companies came out apologetically over some ducks, you know, wouldn't you be like, fuck off?
The book is Ducks, 2 Years in the Oil Sands, written and illustrated by Kate Beaton, and it has stayed with me a lot since I read it. Next time on Depression Mode, Lauren was looking for some answers about her brain and her mental health. So she got tested for autism.
A lot of people have asked, like, why would you even, who cares? Like, you're in your 40s. Like, what does it matter? You've lived your life. You're doing just fine. And it's like, yeah, but I've lived my life with a lot of negative words that have been associated with me, I think. And I think having an answer for those, or at least an explanation, felt important to me.
Our Depression Mode merchandise shop is open for business. You can find all sorts of things in there, t-shirts and hoodies and beanies and all sorts of things, many of them emblazoned with "I'm glad you're here," which is the thing that I say and feel in every episode of this show. All that merchandise is available at maxfunstore.com. That's maxfunstore.com, and just select Depression Mode from all the available shows. If people support our show, we can keep having one. If they don't, we can't. Please help us exist. Donate to the show. If you've donated already, great. You are making a difference. You are getting this show out to people, and it's helping people. So congratulations. If you haven't yet joined the show, it's easy to do. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join and then select a level that works for you and select our show. Boom, you're on your way. Be sure to also hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews. All of that helps us get the word out about the show so it can help people. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available, text the word HOME to 741741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Instagram @depreshpod. And our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search it up. I'm on Twitter @JohnMo. Hi, credits listeners. I think my dog is snoring during the reading of these credits, and I apologize. My dog, Sally, is kind of a sleepyhead. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is Josh from Boise. Remember, you can't be yourself wrongly. There isn't a rule book, and there never was.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.